Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is Europe gearing up for a war on Russia in the near future? Well, according to many European elites and their pliant legacy media, that is exactly the plan. Why Russia is a threat is never really explained. Why do you ask? In fact, is NATO is the greatest threat to European security. Crosstalking War Fever. I'm joined by my guest Ian Proud in London. He is a senior British diplomat and author of Misfit in Moscow, How British Diplomacy in Russia Failed. In Derby, we have Chris Williamson. He is a former member of the British Parliament. And in Belgrade, we cross to Alexander Pavic. He is a member of the Serbian Parliament. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Ian, let me go to you first in London. You spent many years living in Moscow. You know the country, you know the people, but you are right now in London. I assume you're an Englishman here, so you're a good person to ask for a balanced answer. Is Europe getting prepared for war? Because on this side of the line, that's all I see in the headlines. I mean, you have the Secretary General of NATO saying to Britain, if you don't arm more, you better start learning Russian. I mean, we hear these kind of messages over and over again. Sound quite threatening. Ian.
Well, ever since 2014, Europe has done everything to avoid having a war with Russia, but at the same time, it's done everything possible to avoid having peace with Russia. And actually, we've ended up in the situation where Ukraine is stuck in the middle, increasingly a failed state, depopulated, gradually kind of moving towards economic collapse, and the Europeans are claiming victory. So quite frankly, it's not clear what they want.
Okay, well, you know, Chris, essentially the same question here, because Ian mentioned the lack of peace or the lack to drive to peace. You know, if we look at the origins of the European project that became the European Union, it came from the ashes of the Second World War. It was a peace project. That's what it was. And we saw that with reconciliation between France and Germany in the 1950s, and it went forward. Now that project seems to have been turned on its head. Now it is a project for war. Why? Is that the only way the European Union can maintain itself? Is that the only way to keep the Americans in Europe?
Well, I'm very frustrated, Peter, by it, I've got to say, as I think are a lot of people in the UK. I mean, we're led by psychopaths, it seems to me, right across Europe now, and certainly in the United Kingdom. There is this sort of warmongering mentality, and we're now the Labour government. The Labour Party used to have a tradition, or certainly a strong contingent within it, a peace contingent within the Labour Party, but they've been expelled or suspended from the party now. And we now have a parliament which is absolutely gung-ho for war. They want to increase spending on the military up to 5% of GDP. At the same time, as we have 14 to 15 million people living in poverty in the United Kingdom. They've got their priorities completely the wrong way around. Only last year, a Labour government again decided that it was going to scrap what was known as the winter fuel allowance, is basically an allowance which helps older people to pay their fuel bills. We have among the highest, if not the highest, energy bills in Europe and the lowest pension in Western Europe. And a lot of pensioners are really struggling. And even on the Labour Party's own assessment, they calculated, this was before they made the decision when Jeremy Corbyn was leading the party and the previous Conservative government were in power, they calculated that a scrapping the winter fuel allowance would result in 4,000 additional deaths in the elderly population. And yet they went ahead with that, and they've continued to impose other measures, inflicting poverty by limiting the amount of support for families and so on, whilst at the same time throwing money at the military. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And there is a lot of dissatisfaction with the political process in Britain now. The turnout at the last election was the second lowest in history. And, I think people are looking for a genuine alternative. And alternatives are beginning to emerge.
But Chris, that seems to be the problem. And that's what I want to talk about in the second part of the program. Where is public opinion here? And does anyone ever get to vote on these issues? But let me go to Alexander first in Belgrade. But Alexander, does Russia pose a threat to Europe?
The Western elites, Cold War elites do think so. In fact, they're making it into a threat. they're manufacturing it into a threat. And I can tell you firsthand, this isn't new. As everyone knows by now, we were attacked. This country was attacked, Serbia and Montenegro. We were attacked by NATO in 1999 under pretext of a humanitarian intervention, so-called. Well, a year later, there was a very interesting and important meeting in Bratislava in Slovakia. It was organized by the State Department and the American Enterprise Institute. And we know about what was talked about behind closed doors because the then German Chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, sent an emissary there, a former high German official, Willy Wimmer was his name, is his name, he's still alive. And he submitted a report regarding what the hot, very high American diplomats and military officials said at that conference as to why Yugoslavia was attacked by NATO. And this is very significant. I'm reading from the letter itself. It says, NATO, the war against Yugoslavia was fought to rectify an incorrect decision of General Eisenhower during World War II. In this manner, because of the strategic reasons demanding the stationing of US soldiers in this region, the faulty determination has been corrected. And another point, this is even more important, NATO should now fill the area between the Baltic and Anatolia, which is today's Turkey, as it was filled by Roman forces during the height of the Roman Empire. So as we can see, we had people with imperial ambitions pulling all the strings in Washington in the first place at the time. And this is in line of what General Wesley Clark talked about, what he heard at the Pentagon after September 11. He said there was a policy coup there. Some very hard-nosed people practically took over policy in Washington. But actually, it happened a little bit before. And these are the neocons. These are the warmongers. These are the hawks.
Well, Alexander, since you're bringing up Wesley Clark, let me throw it to Ian. We all know the story of the countries that we're supposed to follow. The last one is being challenged right now, and that's Iran. But in a continuation of what Alexander was saying, where is the peace overtures here? I mean, if we don't want to go to war, we must make sure we don't go to war. We need negotiations. We need dialogue. That seems to be completely absent right now.
I know. And for a long time before Donald Trump was elected as U.S. president, any overtures towards dialogue with Russia was roundly criticized in parliament, in the media, you know, in the West, and so on. People like Viktor Orban, when he had his kind of peace mission, he was being criticized by Donald Tusk on X. And anybody was called a Putin puppet if they merely picked up the phone and said, well, how can we end this war? And it's quite bizarre. There's been a complete departure from diplomacy and dialogue, actually right back to 2014 and the onset of the Ukraine crisis. And that has to end. And even though I think actually Donald Trump is kind of hemmed in himself within the Beltway in BC and trying to fight his way out of that, not to mention fight his way through recalcitrance among European leaders. At the very least, he's trying to actually use dialogue to find a way forward. Whether he can remains to be seen.
Yeah, but, Chris, I'm not really, Trump is his own worst enemy when it comes to Ukraine, in my opinion, because it shows that there is no strategy there. But, when the stakes are so high, war is the most serious thing you can deal with here. And it would seem to me, during the Cold War, the Soviet Union dealt with the West and the West dealt with the Soviet Union. I mean, it's far worse now. Why is that?
Well, I think I go back to my previous point. I mean, we're led by psychopaths. I mean, back in the day when the Cold War was at its height during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, Kennedy and Khrushchev were able to talk to one another. And even then, the nuclear doomsday clock was not as close to midnight as it is today. So we're in a much more precarious situation, it seemed to me. But, Smedley Butler summed it up, didn't he, 100 years ago when he described war as a racket? It absolutely is. He said that, he was a muscle man for Wall Street. And You know, it was Eisenhower, wasn't it, who in his valedictory speech in 1961 warned about the power of the military, and indeed he coined the phrase, the military-industrial complex. And, you know, speculation is that that was one of the reasons that, you know, that Kennedy was assassinated, because, you know, he talked about not just peace in our time, but peace for all time, and talked about, yes, we had our ideological differences in the United States with the Soviet Union, but in the end, we're all human beings, and we need to find a way of rubbing along with one another. And, you know, it seems to me that, you know, that theory that that was one of the reasons he was killed, I think, does hold a lot of water for me.
Well, it's also, but you said ideological. Let me go to Alexander before we go to the break here. I may be in the minority on this, and, you know, criticize me if you want. But, you know, Russia isn't a neoliberal country. It doesn't have Western liberal values. It's a very conservative place. The West doesn't like that. It wants to force its way because it is the garden, if we were told a few years ago, and we're, the rest of us are in the jungle. What do you think about that, Alexander? It's cultural as well.
It is cultural. It's economic. It's even religious. I remember there were memoirs written after the NATO aggression against Yugoslavia, and one of the reasons that was given by, I think it was Strobe Talbot, said that actually Yugoslavia was bombed because it wasn't in tune with the new neoliberal concept. You know, we still had a kind of a socialist government, a leftover throwback led by former communists, Milosevic, who was still trying to wage some kind of semi-socialist policy. And actually you have on record a high American official saying that's not good enough. We want neoliberalism in former Yugoslavia. So that holds for Russia as well. And if we remember, Yeltsin was quite good for the West because he was actually enforcing this neoliberal concept in Russia. And yeah. As long as well, he was doing that.
And we all know how that failed. And that's why I always say to people is that the West created the conditions for someone like Vladimir Putin. And they're living there, and now they're regretting it. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on war fever. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVelch. Remind you, we're discussing war fever. I want to go back to Ian in London. Is at the core of all of this is NATO. And you can agree or disagree with me, but, you know, a military alliance that is aggressive, we have a witness, Alexandra, on the program to confirm that, but a military alliance in Europe that is designed against Russia, without Russia, creates inherent insecurity. And that's what really needs to be addressed here. And no one in power, I agree with Chris, most of them are psychopaths, and Donald Trump doesn't have the intellectual depth to think in those terms here. But that's what we have to consider. I've said for a long time, to solve the Ukraine problem, you go big and then you go small. You look at European security architecture first, and then Ukraine will be solved. Go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, NATO is now completely outdated, and of course, its decision to increase spending to 5% of GDP will mean that it accounts for, you know, almost two-thirds of total global military spending.
Do you think that's just that is just political theater? Would you agree? I mean, this is good. It's planned out years and years. None of the people in power now will be around in 2035.
Oh, I get that. I get that, Peter. Yeah, I get that. But, I mean, the Germans want to do it by 2029. So, I mean, that should be a separate cause for concern, German remilitarization. But you're absolutely right. I mean, NATO is no longer kind of really fit for purpose. There needs to be, you know, if Trump really does want to leave Europe to stand on its own two feet, then that must place an imperative on Europeans to actually have that big discussion that includes Russia as well about European security architecture writ large. I completely agree with you on that, actually.
Well, Chris, but there's no political will to go that direction, which I find it bewildering, because there are alternatives. Everyone can compromise. Again, this is what we did during the Cold War. I mean, arms control was a major breakthrough. I mean, I remember those days, hiding under your desk and, all those things here. And then they came to an agreement. There's no inclination even to move in that direction, which would benefit the Russians as much as it would Europeans.
Absolutely. Not only are they not moving in that direction, they're moving in the very opposite direction. And look, when the Soviet Union was still in existence, I mean, that was a bulwark. There was, two very powerful entities, I think, which kept an equilibrium. But after the Soviet Union collapsed, the United States, NATO, it felt they'd won. And, they abused their position. And, James Baker's commitment to Gorbachev that they wouldn't expand one inch eastward if Gorbachev agreed to a German unification. And then NATO's kind of doubled in size. And, prior to the military operation in Ukraine, you'll recall that Russia proposed a draft treaty that would have actually prevented the war from happening in the first place. But this was completely rejected by the United States, by NATO. Indeed, there were articles in the Atlantic Council talking about the strategic case for risking war in Ukraine. The U.S. Defense Department commissioned the RAND Corporation to do a report on how to overextend and weaken Russia. And we've heard, haven't we, from key figures in the elites in the United States that their ultimate aim is to balkanize Russia, because there are obviously rich pickings if they can achieve that, and then pivot towards China. These people are completely mad. But my only hope is that, they're out of step with their electorates.
Yes.
And, that will, in the fullness of time, I'm hopefully not too long a time, will actually result in these governments falling. But when politicians come to the fore who are hostile to NATO, hostile to the United States, well, they use every dirty trick in the book, don't they, to stop them actually going forward. I mean, there's been a number of examples. One in France, for example, where the kind of left coalition won, but the French president decided that he was going to appoint as prime minister one of his own people.
This is the problem, because the elites, let me go to Alexander here, the elites won't allow it to be on the agenda. Let's look at what happened in Romania. Oh, the wrong guy won, so he canceled the election. Extraordinary lengths. I mean, I wonder if any European EU country could put on the ballot, should we continue our support of the Ukraine conflict? I bet there's not really one country that would go along with it. But that will never be allowed to be put on the ballot, because these same psychopaths that Chris uses, I like that term too, they'll never let democracy determine Europe's foreign policy, particularly vis-a-vis Russia.
Absolutely. And let me tell you, this militarization, this war fever that's going on, it's actually, the purpose is to actually prevent a change of elites, to prevent honest elections, because they need this outside threat in order to militarize. And when you militarize, you become more authoritarian, and people generally homogenize and coalesce around whoever's ruling the country, even if it's a very bad government. And I think that's why they're ramping up the fever so much, because they're afraid of free and fair elections, as they've shown in France and especially in Romania. So even though they know they don't have the capacity to wage war with Russia, but it's the atmosphere, it's the war fever that's important in order to keep this atmosphere up, to keep this pretense up, and to actually, this is a war against democracy as well. This is a war against fair elections and against people's real will.
Ian, I can't help but have the feeling that this war fever that's reaching a pitch, it's really a strategy to keep Trump in European affairs? Because considering the woes that Trump is having now, and it's still early days, there could be a different president from a different party in 2029. And they're waiting Trump out, and having this war fever keeps the Americans interested, okay? Because the Americans are being played by the Europeans. I mean, Rutte's a whole shtick when he was visiting Washington was an embarrassment to humanity. I mean, Trump comes out with this really ridiculous thing about Europe will buy it, they'll give it to Ukraine and all. It's been dissected now. It doesn't make any sense. We know after that meeting, many European countries didn't even know that was on the agenda, but Rutte there was just nodding his head, you know, Daddy, you're absolutely right. Is Trump just being played? Is this a stratagem to play Trump? Ian?
Well, I don't really think Europe has a strategy, but I do think lots of politicians, including Rutte, want to kind of wait him out. But the problem is, before that happens, Europe will have run out of money to support the war, particularly now that Trump insists on the Europeans buying all the weapons, including from, you know, American defense contractors. And actually, increasingly, voters will say, well, hold on a minute. You know, we're cutting, or trying to cut benefits to disabled people. Our doctors in the UK, that is, are going on strike yet again. Our NHS still can't reduce waiting lists. Why are we pumping £4.5 billion into the war in Ukraine every year and increasing our defence spending? Let's focus on our domestic priorities. So I don't actually think, and you see that across Europe, Germany in particular, but France as well, Central European countries too, like Romania. I don't think Europe has 4 years to wait this out because they just don't have the money to do it, and Russia does.
You know, Chris, is there any appetite in Europe to see a remilitarized Germany?
Well, you know, looking at the sort of the public opinion, that doesn't seem to be the case. But the elites, you know, the political elites just carry on regardless. And this is where I come back to the kind of whole democratic point that you were touching on as well. I mean, listen, if military action was determined by the people, then we wouldn't have these wars, you know. And I think it's really important. I mean, it was Tony Benn, wasn't he, who said that democracy is the most revolutionary thing in the world. And, you know, clearly, the elites talk a good talk about their commitment to democracy. But when push comes to shove, in reality, they are totally opposed to it. I mean, in terms of, you know, running out of money, that is a feature for the European Union countries that are inside the Eurozone, because they're not in control of their own currency. The currency is issued by the European Central Bank. That isn't a problem for the United Kingdom, which issues its own currency. So in reality, money's no object for the United Kingdom government, although they don't actually make that clear to the public. The only restriction on a government that issues its currency is the availability of real resources in the economy. So if they wanted to, you know, they could actually increase the spend on military and actually support the social welfare and a good society. But, you know, in reality, what we should be saying is, well, how can we find a way of rubbing along with the world in a sort of way that JFK was talking about all those years ago? Because, you know, the average British person doesn't have an argument with the average Russian individual. It's just absolutely ludicrous. These are you know, wars of the elites. But this enmity in the United Kingdom towards Russia, I mean, it kind of predates the Soviet Union. I mean, going back, you know, well over 100, 150 years, you know, to the Crimean War. I don't know what it is with the elites in the United Kingdom.
Well, I mean, Chris, but it's a very convenient other, isn't it? I mean, we're better. At least I'm an Englishman. I'm not a Russian. Okay. I mean, it's a form of racism as well. Okay. I mean, I've been thinking about doing a series of programs on comparative Russophobia in Germany, France, the UK. I mean, it would be very, very interesting. Most European countries have a beef with the Russians for one reason or another. It's not always exactly the same. But it does go back to my cultural issue that Alexander spoke about. Last 40 seconds go to you, Alexander.
Yeah, well, let's remember, ever since Europe split into two, Catholic and Orthodox, into the Eastern Roman Empire and Western Roman Empire, there has been this dynamic of especially the Catholic West expanding towards the East, and Russia was seen as terra missionaris. That actually has just transformed, as Europe has transformed, It's no longer Christian, but it still retains its aggression and its urge
well,
to go
you know,
east.
Alexander, I mean, you know, they talk about the Great Schism, you know, and how Orthodoxy is the schematics. In my, where I live right now, we look at the West as the heretics, okay, in every single sense, a cultural sense. So there's a there's a huge divide to be a bridge there. Gentlemen, fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in London, Derby, and in Belgrade. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here on RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.